I was this morning giving the guest lecture at the Crop Science Society of Agronomy. I can't even say it. That shows that I lost my marbles. Crop Science Society award ceremony. And there I was talking very much about what breeding and genetics can achieve. And today I try to say what breeding can and cannot achieve. And I'm taking the crop varietal development for sustainable intensification in a quite narrow sense. I think I wasn't here for the previous sessions, but I'm sure that you have talked about the unprecedented demand growth for agricultural commodity that requires us to increase or to go the pathway of systems intensification. If we don't do it, what will result, part of it, is uncontrolled area expansions going into forest, into hill slopes. That's unsustainable. From the FAO side, there are estimates that world agriculture in the developing world could extend by another 20% before it encroaches and does damage to the extent we do not want to have happen, unless some feel that has already happened. Now, maize area alone, maize is the one that is currently growing the most rapidly. Maize is the one that becomes the, is already globally the biggest crop. It will become as well in the developing world the biggest crop. It grows at 2.2% annually. That is not necessarily going into new area, partially yes, but also taking up the space of other crops. So if we took the 20%, we would have less than 10 years, and maize has its share of the cultivated land already gobbled up. Yield trends have gone down. I show you here the graphs of wheat. They are particularly pronounced for wheat and rice, but also for maize, if you look at the major food crops. The trends behind this decrease are several-fold: decreased investment in agricultural R&D, but also climate change and displacing wheat into less productive area through the growth of use of maize for biofuel. This shows us that systems, it's not just an issue of farming systems, but systems, you can look at them in a very different scale from local to a landscape level to global, in the sense that we see changes in yields of actually global changes of cropping pattern. In terms of climate trends on crop production, David Lobel recently published this that shows that part of, I mean, as well confirms that part of this decreasing slope in wheat, but also in maize, are due to climate change that's already happening. And so far, we have probably seen the least of it. Of particularly worry to us is that maize, you know it as corn, as a C4 crop, has usually been looked at as a relatively heat-tolerant crop, and that is true. However, the growth optimum is far from 32 or 36 degree. We were looking here at long-term trials trials that we conducted annually in Africa across the continent, and we're looking what is the heat impact of these trials on maize production. And what we see, the top graph that is the green line, you see that yields become to linearly decrease once temperature go above 23 degrees. These are average growth period temperature. What is concerning is that when you combine heat with drought, these decreases are linearly happening already at very low temperature. So the combined impacts on and the challenges to being able to intensify our production may be steeper in the case of maize than we thought previously. So demand growth are coming together with converging challenges of climate change, water scarcity or increasing cost, nutrients-depleted soils and energy, and this is the reason for us to look at how can we produce more with less resources. We summarize it. Rob was talking about the CGIAR research programs. We summarize it like this. If we wanted to have food prices to remain constant, that is in terms of purchasing power, of not necessarily in dollar terms, but in purchasing power, the annual yield gains that we currently experience in the major fruit crops, maize, rice, and wheat, would have gone up by about 50%, and we are far from that. And this would have to happen on the same land area with less water, less nutrients, fossil fuel, and labor. And this is really, if we talk about intensifying a system, what the big challenge is. I'm sure that Andy may have shown this result, these results in his presentation. These are results from India that show the yield gap that exists in South Asia. You see green, the average yield on farm, yellow, the experimental yields and simulated potential yield is red. And you would say 50% can be done through management. And this is one thing in terms of systems intensification that we cannot disregard. If I'm to talk about varietal contributions, the big contributions are to come from improved management. And the reason that they are not happening partially are the lack of agronomists, the lack of extension personnel that are the results of decreased investment in R&D. The diffusion of modern varieties, they are variable here for rice, wheat, maize, sorghum, cassava, and potatoes. This is out of the World Development Report. We see wheat has the highest adoption, but as a self-pollinated crop, it sustains itself. Maize, we are around 50%. And then in other crops, less, particularly sorghum, cassava. The diffusion of modern varieties in terms of what can varieties contribute to systems intensification is probably the biggest effect. The mere fact that adapted varieties to adapted to a particular system, or that the farmer doesn't have the choice of such a variety, that they are not there, is probably the biggest gap of what crop breeding could contribute. It is not the genotype by environment or genotype by system interaction, but the mere fact that the seed is not there. As well, we need to be quite clear about what actually triggers a farmer to adopt, to close the yield gap, to intensify the system. Simit is working in three systems, major systems in South Asia that Andy was talking about, Africa maize legume systems in collaboration with a whole range of other centers, IITA, SIAT, ILRI, ICRAF and ICRISAT, and in Mesoamerica in collaboration with the Mexican government on a whole range of systems. It is not that you give a farmer a recommendation. The farmer needs to be able, particularly if the farmer is poor, wealthy and poor farmers want to realize increased incomes, but if the farmer is poor, they will not be happy with a long-term average. They need to be able to reduce the risk through the methods that we are promoting. Increased profitability, increased sustainability, those are incentives. As a result, you would want to implement climate-averse technologies, know-how that is lacking at farm level, at widespread, improved input and output markets, and price stability. Those are reason for adoption of improved or incentives for adoption of improved systems. What breeding can do in this is to get the varieties there, to get it in a locally adapted context. So if we are taking crop breeding contributions in a very narrow sense, I mean, what we want to achieve is looking at the systems level, at the farm level, at the landscape level, or at the country level, and want to increase income yield biomass at constant or reduced land, water, nutrients, labor, and energy. And the system doesn't just go across crops. It's not just a question, so that's why I include income, is how the farmers use the crop for livestock. Breeding progress, often cited, it's agricultural productivity increase in a bag of seed, whether it increases land use efficiency, water use efficiency, through a whole range of mechanisms. This is a time series of Simit wheat lines where we looked at to what extent has the yield increased over time. And interesting, I showed you before this wheat trend that is leveling off. And actually what you see now on nurseries that we have maintained the gain in spite of potential, and this is based on international trials. We have maintained yield increase in spite of somewhat approaching climate or heat impact. So which essentially says that our yield increases have gone up. But if you now say, well, this is the contribution to systems intensification, our physiologists were looking at what are these advanced lines doing. They are called syn-derived lines because they are coming from wild white crosses. We call them synthetic wheats. This is pulling in new genetics from the wild ancestors. What you see is that they extract more water from deeper soil profile. You increase yield, you increase water use, you increase nutrient use. Global food production is linearly related to nutrient use. So systems implication of this, I think it comes down to using water and nutrients that otherwise would be lost through improved varieties. Systems intensification often mistaken for high potential yield, breeding for high yield potential. Well, the higher the yields, the greater the losses. There is need for stress tolerance. These are world yields of maize, red, rice, blue, and wheat, green. You see the biggest variation for maize or the corn yields, and this is because most of the maize compared to rice is produced in rain-fed areas, and it's less, maize is less drought-tolerant than wheat is. You would assume we heard about Eastern Africa and the severe drought there. We know Africa returning drought, that this is an issue particularly for Africa. However, this has taken the maize yield variation apart by continent, and what you see is that the biggest variation actually occur here, exactly on this continent, because there is the biggest production. And for example, in the case of China, there is, if you look at the Asia line, the top line, there's a pronounced impact that goes down. China raised its maize yield drastically, and through that drought had the first most drastic impact on production. So intense system need stress tolerance. That's as well, we were recently analyzing, CIMIT has a substantive drought-tolerant maize for Africa breeding program with support from Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, the United States, and a range of other donors. We were looking where is the highest payoff. We were looking at the various areas in Africa. You see yellow, the most drought-prone areas, and green, the more fertile, higher intensive systems. And if you calculate this through in terms of drought tolerance, where does it have the biggest impact? It actually has the greatest impact in the lower risk zones. And the reason is farmers invest in those, they have higher yields, and as the drought comes, the reduction is greater. It's in magnitude. Pest diseases often mentioned in terms of their changing pattern in systems. I don't want to go into this. I think these effects are well known. For example, downy mildew is promoted by continuous cropping in Asia, in Africa as well, where irrigation is coming out. Stem borers promoted by dual maize cropping. We have much higher pressures in Eastern Africa than we have in Southern Africa, where we only have one season. There are new such systems impacts, and again, they go beyond farms emerging. For example, wheat blast is a new potential threat to global wheat production. It's the same as rice blast. We know very little about it. We know very little of what triggers this jump and to what extent this become a global issue. Adaptation to intercropping. Very often we hear the suggestions, what about you select for maize varieties that do better in intercropping systems? Or the legume breeder probably hears, what about you select for legumes that do better in intercropping systems? We did some research on it. You can find differences, but it's not an issue about precision. It's an issue where we have yield gaps of 50% of possible yields. It's not an issue of precision and to find differences. It's an issue of relevance. So ultimately what we came to the conclusion, if you're a maize breeder, the maize is the winner in terms of what you select and the legume is the loser. And if you're a legume breeder, you probably select for. And actually the biggest difference is probably in what you do with maturity. And you find quite highly sophisticated systems, for example, in China, where they choose maturity adapted to a particular system. It is not the architecture of the maize or the architecture of the legume. You can find significant differences, but they are not relevant in the bigger picture. Relevant in the bigger picture is, again, this has to do with seed not being there where it is needed in the right form, in the right varieties. For example, in Colombia, oil palm producers and coffee producers came to us and were saying, we want to utilize the land that is bare before we have productive systems. They didn't have access to varieties that were commercially available or that they could buy seed of it. And when they grew the varieties, the maize varieties that were available, they had the wrong disease resistance. So cropping in new zones, it's very often connected to making adapted varieties, and adaptation often has to do with disease resistance and making seed system operational in those areas. One substantive genotype by management interaction that we are utilizing is in wheat, in terms that we are evaluating all our wheat varieties on raised beds. And Annie has shown how much more important these systems have become in Asia, and we see consistent enough interactions between wheat varieties that are selected on raised bed than on the flat. In the case of maize, you go into conservation agriculture, you have higher disease pressures, selection for insect resistance. You don't necessarily have to choose the system as a whole, but you can look at it and break it down in its component. We did not feel in the case of wheat that we could really identify what causes the GBI management interaction, so we simply used the system as a selection tool. Another example that's often mentioned is, why don't you select for feed value? Again, that has been done largely in developed economies. Silage quality, stover quality is a well-known breeding term. What about in the developing world, where we have a whole range of systems around livestock? I give you here just a snapshot of a PRA in Ethiopia, that's participatory rural appraisals done in Ethiopia over maize stover quality. There is a very large diversity of how people use maize stover, not only as fodder, but as building materials, and it creates incentive in a particular system. It is particularly important where cropping has overtaken grazing. The grazing land is reducing, so there you can say stover and the stover value becomes more important. It is also the case that farmers do recognize the stover value. We often think we can only do that with sophisticated equipment, but farmers do recognize it. However, the most favored variety in Ethiopia, BH660, it is a very large biomass producer, but it has very poor stover palatability, and farmers know that. Still, it is the largest, it's the most important variety. So again, you can identify differences, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a system change. On the other hand, in southern Ethiopia, you find, for example, that the local variety is indeed grown because animals do prefer it. It stays green longer, and the stalk has a higher water content, or it's more palatable. You also see other types of connections, for example, that stover comes on the market if green maize comes on the market. So there are other types of systems interactions that if you just very narrow-mindedly go in as a breeder and says, I breed for the ones that have the highest nutritional value, you completely overlook. You overlook the big picture. So the question is not about precision. The question is about relevance. The question is not about that you can establish varieties, but how relevant are those differences in a systems context. Interesting example, and maybe, so I talked many, essentially what I'm saying you here is let's look particularly in the developing world at the big factors that are so far creating the yield gaps. There are, however, as well, surprises. For example, in post-harvest storage, often mentioned as an income generator because farmers can grow grain for a longer time, or as a food security measure, if actually they introduced in Central America these metal silos for grain storage, what they discovered, actually the biggest system change, was that farmers increased their livestock holding and generated a higher income through an improved value chain. So we are working something, unexpected changes. In many instances I talked about where breeding cannot contribute, unexpected changes. We see, for example, big variety differences that we never expected in terms of post-harvest pest resistance. So, myth and realities was mentioned before. Myth and realities I mentioned here in terms of what varieties can contribute. I think in terms in summary, is that the focus, the increase of yield, water and nutrient use efficiency breeding is a bullet, a golden bullet or a silver bullet in that wherever we achieve a higher use of water and nutrients that otherwise are lost out of the systems, we gain. Different to many perceptions, stress tolerance is actually very much needed in intensive systems. Maturity and fitting varieties through its maturity variation into cropping systems pattern, going from 1 to 2 harvests, from 2 to 3, looking at what later or earlier maturing varieties contribute in terms of biomass to livestock. Those are some of the most important interventions in the developing world. Disease and pest resistance has been well documented. I showed you an example where we use crop by management interactions in the case of zero till. But I also, from our perspective, we have not included breeding for intercropping or breeding for feed value as a high priority, because there are other interventions that are at this stage for farmers that want to move into systems intensification of higher value, like, for example, drought tolerance. A whole range of people contributed to this presentation in terms of trying to find out where can variety breeding. And I took this in a very, very narrow sense. I mean, in terms of breeding has contributed, we can break it down. We often say breeding, agronomy, policy, each of them contribute to increasing productivity in our world, in the developing world. If you take this in a very, very narrow sense and says, what can, if a breeder goes and says, I want to breed for a system, what should that breeder do? Well, first of all, the breeder should take a step back. And so these colleagues from all around the world, Ethiopia, Mexico, Zimbabwe, and these are places, many of these colleagues have moved on, Colombia, Kenya, and collaborations with other organizations like ILRI, IIT, University of Georgia, contributed to this talk. Thank you very much. Myths and realities.